And today's podcast is brought to you in part by our friends at Tailwind Nutrition.
Tailwind Nutrition. And Scott, my tip of the trail today for Tailwind Nutrition is this. Our schedules have been off a little bit, so we haven't been able to hold one another accountable to the morning run. And so too often, I have rationalized with myself that, hey, sleep is training too, right? Only if you're training. If you haven't been doing any training.
If sleep has become a larger part of your training than running,
then you'll become very good at sleeping and not that good at running.
I'm an expert, by the way.
The other excuse when I'm horizontal with my head on the pillow and the covers up by my head is I can run in the afternoon. That's never going to happen. There are too many things that come up in a busy day that never let that happen, even though in the morning you think, hey, it's a little warmer in the afternoon. You know, I can get out there later.
Never happens.
Never. And so I've implemented this strategy, which is an old strategy, but sometimes we're reminded of it, therefore the tip. I decide the night before, I commit myself. That's when I make the decision, am I running or not? I don't wait to debate with myself after the alarm goes off, because guess what? At 4:30 in the morning, I can very easily rationalize that sleep is good training and I can run in the afternoon. But that night when I go to bed and I set that alarm, decision's made. I'm up and went out there and ran and had a glorious run this morning. It was fantastic. Loved it. Felt good. Well rested and felt good. So
I'm going to wax a little philosophic and say that that can translate into many other aspects of your life. If you make the decision beforehand, let's say you're running a 50 miler for the first time. If you make the decision beforehand, I am going to push through this. There is no other option than finish. I think that once you make that decision and commitment to yourself before you get into the situation, you're better off with success.
I may have had success this morning on this run because I filled my bottle with raspberry buzz.
Caffeinated,
Tailwind, all you need all day. Really, it's
maybe
true.
That's what helped you get up.
That's what. I was drawn to the bottle, right? and so it doesn't taste too sweet. It's good stuff. We've been talking about it a long time. Pour yourself a bottle of Tailwind. Get out there in the morning,
and run.
We'd like to thank audiblepodcast.com for helping bring this podcast to life. Scott?
Audible. You know, we talk about all the many thousands of books that you can download and listen to, whether you're driving or running or whatever. But one thing that we haven't mentioned is with your subscription, you actually get the Wall Street Journal. Did you know that, Don?
No, and I'm a little bit appalled that you haven't told me that, Scott.
Daily, the Wall Street Journal downloads an Audible summary of what's in the Wall Street Journal. And the best part is on the weekend, they have a weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal that is fascinating. So if you want to stay up on the current events, go to audible.com. And you can get this free by going to audiblepodcast.com/TRN.
Scott, you are always listening to great books. You're sharing stories, and I think it's a great resource. And we have a lot of time where we can't read, but we can plug this stuff in our ears and become better at whatever we do.
So go listen.
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation.
Andy Jones Wilkins.
Ian Torrance.
Scott War.
Don Freeman.
It's the end of the year, 2014.
The year in review, Scott. And we couldn't be more excited about talking about some of the highlights. We've each been assigned, much like grab bag or drop bag, to bring a couple notable accomplishments, observations, and who knows what we have in store, because I only know my two.
And we do have a fifth character on the podcast today.
What character would that be? That's a little soft, Scott. I think you need to turn your gong up a bit. Nice. Now, so we put some clarity to this. Andy Jones Wilkins, can you describe why we have a gong and kind of how it came to be?
Well, we did a podcast a little more than a year ago at Craig Thornley's house in Auburn after the Western States lottery. And we thought that, and they actually have a gong, a real gong there in their house. And we thought that it would be fun to hit the gong anytime we felt like it, pretty much.
Yeah.
particularly anytime somebody said something interesting, notable, or stupid.
Now, as I recall, you were drinking a bit of Sierra Nevada at night, and the gong became a little more...
the frequency of the gong was directly proportionate to the amount of intoxication.
it may very well have been. I don't recall.
Well, good. Shall we start off with this year in review? And let's go with Andy Jones-Wilkins first, AJW. Let's start with your topic and then just roll around the table. Ian, you're next. The rules are comment if you have comment to make to either help support or deny the person's entry.
Well, my first one has nothing to do with people, but it has to do with shoes. I think we saw the death of minimalism and maybe the return to equilibrium when it comes to the absurdity both in large shoes and small shoes. So my number one year in review topic is shoes getting back to the real world.
I actually talked you took one of my things, but that's all right.
Yeah, I knew.
But I went to the source. I talked to Hal Kerner at Rogue Valley Runners and Josh Brimhall at Red Rock Running Company last night. And yes, that is what they said. The rise of maximal shoes are returned. Well, maximal shoes continue to be on the rise. Almost every shoe company is coming out with a maximal shoe now. So more like the rise of the Hoka.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's going to be an interesting pattern to look at, by the way, into 2015, because it could be that 2015 becomes kind of even more of a equilibrium setting for shoes. And since pretty much any time you talk to a bunch of runners, they're obsessed with shoes, it's probably a good topic to start out with today anyway.
It's a topic we all love to talk about. Scott, I stepped on your shoe. What did you have to say?
I was going to say, you know, the sole thickness, I think, has gotten back to a norm. But have you noticed that the drop, the heel to toe drop, has minimalized or decreased, so that even if it's a regular thickness, you're not seeing the 13, 14, 15 inch or 15 millimeter angle. It's more of a, I think the norm is probably less than 8, maybe 4 millimeters.
It's kind of the sweet spot. You know, 6 to 8-ish instead of the 15-ish that we were accustomed to.
Do you think that that's a fad, or do you think that's going to stay?
AJW?
I think that's probably going to stay somewhere in that 4 to 8 millimeter drop. You know, I got into these Hoka Cliftons in the middle of the year, and they felt like, I don't know if Ian agrees, but Ian, remember the Maasai from back in the day?
Wait, I remember. I ran in the Maasai, Andy.
I used to. This Clifton shoe, aside from the fact that they couldn't grip the ground at all, was the best shoe I've had since the Maasai. Even though the Maasai used to pretty much fall off your feet after like 200 miles, it was some of the best 200 miles you've ever had. So anything that returns to that, I think, is a good thing.
I'm not familiar with Maasai. Who made that? Who made that shoe?
Montreal.
Yeah.
Oh, Montreal. Okay.
And you're right. The outers lasted about 200 miles, and it was a perfect marketer's, you know, opportunity, because the thing would fall apart. It was no question whether you had more miles on the shoe. You just looked down. And if you could see your socks, they were done.
You know, one of the things that I've liked about the shoe evolution is there's less sewing on these shoes. They're using some kind of a glue or a laminate to hold these things together, and so they're actually cool looking shoes with less seams.
They're getting expensive. Some of these shoes cost a lot of money. You know, I mean, you could find a shoe for $175. I think Salomon, one of their flagship shoes, is in that area. It's just not
usually it was about $100, less than $100.
Back in the day, you could get in a shoe for $30.
$30?
I don't know.
You still can. Salvation Army.
Oh,
Gonged it.
Oh, are we moving on? Hang on.
We're gonging. You've got to be a... Scott, you get me on the gong, all right?
The 30-buck line requires a gong.
Okay.
You could figure out my age if you took the cost of a shoe and backed it up. You would find out exactly how old I am.
Were they hook and latch, or were they laces back then?
They had zero drop, I'll tell you that. They were the Converse All-Star. Okay, ready to move on? Ian.
Move on.
Ian.
How about the year of Mother Nature?
Well, for you, absolutely.
Yeah.
With your race.
Well, we had in Arizona alone, and you guys chime in after I'm done, but in Arizona alone, we had four major races significantly impacted, canceled, or shortened because of weather. Old Pueblo down in Tucson, Zane Grey was shortened to a 50K. Stagecoach was canceled, and Mogollon Monster was canceled, all because of crazy weather. Snowstorms, blizzards, tornadoes, lightning, hail.
North Face up here was in San Francisco was altered a bit. The course was changed because of weather.
Rain.
Yeah.
And I know, I think one of Varner's rain shadow races was canceled because of fire.
Mother Nature's angry. Is she angry at the sport or just angry in general?
I don't know.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I enjoy about the sport. It is you know, you take our local flagship race, the Western States 100, and it can be a vastly different race from year to year depending on Mother Nature. Sometimes even the course changes, but basically it's the same course, but it can be extremely different from year to year.
You know, I would add to the Ian's Mother Nature point that it's the issues around Mother Nature have been they're greater for race directors as more and more new people come into the sport and they're less experienced. The days of pretty much knowing that anyone was going to be able to deal with anything are kind of gone for RDs. And so while I think all of those cancellations and shortenings were appropriate, I think we're also a lot more on pins and needles about when we need to pull the plug on races based on who we have showing up. I remember an event a few years ago, the Pocatello 50, that I think it has a new name now, but it was called the Pocatello 50 back then. It was run by Jared Campbell out in Idaho. And he had it was a 50-mile race, but it was also a 3-person relay. And all the 50-mile racers were pretty much well prepared for whatever was going to come their way. But these relay runners, who were all pretty much, you know, weekend warriors running 10 to 15 miles, had no expectation of snow coming on June 1st. And about halfway through the race, Jared had to pull the plug. So I think one of the things that Mother Nature's impact on races is going to continue to put into play is how RDs calibrate when they have their races, when they decide to pull the plug on them, and maybe even who they let in.
Well, and speaking of Jared Campbell and Mother Nature, how about when he got hit by lightning this year at Hard Rock? That was quite a story.
That was Adam Campbell, though. Different.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was
gong
Adam Campbell.
For gong.
Gong for getting the wrong Campbell. And Jared right now is a little bit concerned that maybe he forgotten about his lightning strike.
Some amnesia.
He was hit so hard that it slipped. Hey, and you guys are both race directors. And let's just talk a little bit about how we as a community should kind of take that decision that an RD makes.
Right.
So it's tough for a race director to pull the plug on their race. They've been working all year on it. And in all the preparation, the many, many hours, not only for that race director, but volunteers. And I think as a community, we should support our race director and you know, empathize with them in their position and not complain and just be overall good stewards of the trail and be supportive members of our community.
You may be disappointed because you've put in a lot of training to get to that point, to that starting line, but you also got to realize those race directors have put in as much or more effort planning and preparing for the race. So,
that's my question for these two guys. Do you put more hours into prepping for a race for yourself to wear a bib or creating your race? Let's start with Ian, because he looks most ready to answer. Because I think you're frozen, Andy.
That's so you can wake up, Ian.
No, we've lost.
We've lost Ian.
We've lost both of them.
I'm back here.
Oh, okay. Hold on 1 second. We've lost. And now we're bringing back.
Here I am. I'm back.
Okay,
sorry.
Good.
I don't know what happened.
Well, that's okay. So, Ian, it's Mother Nature once again. Now, yes. Ian, do you put more time and prep and hours into preparing for your own race that you're running or one you're directing?
One I'm directing, because I'm just not responsible for myself, but 100 people or more.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's pretty stressful, and you want everything to go right.
AJW, do you concur?
You know, yeah, I had my inaugural RD experience this past March, and I'm actually looking forward to doing it again, having gotten the kinks out of it. I have to agree with Ian. The stress I felt in, and mine's a relatively low key. It's all in a county park. It's multiple loops. There's two aid stations. The stuff that can go wrong is small, comparatively speaking. But the responsibility you feel, combined with the kind of the blood, sweat, and tears you put into the event, really makes it much more challenging than going out and running your own race. When you go out and run your own race, you're just like, it's all about you, you know. But when you're race directing, it's almost nothing about you and all about everybody else.
Good. I think that's pretty consistent with most race directors. You see them, and they look more worn than some of the runners when they're finished with the race.
Would you, as a race director, ever consider running the race that you're directing?
Huh. All right.
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think I would either.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen one run it. They usually end up picking up a race that they would like to run. So I imagine there's a bit of you that designed the course, and it's probably one of your favorite type of terrains or profiles. You'd probably like to go out there and put your feet on the trail. So I think that'd be a tough one. Okay, are we ready to move on? Do you guys have anything more to add to that? The gong says move.
Gong says move.
When the gong speaks, we move. Scott, you or I, who do you want to go?
I'll go.
All right.
So mine is about a person.
Okay.
Don and I were lucky to go out.
Oh, you just took mine, Scott.
That's why I decided to go first.
Okay.
we were fortunate enough to go out to Hard Rock this year at Silverton, Colorado, and witness the athletic prowess and almost supernatural, superhuman capabilities of Killian Jornet. He shattered the course record, and the times that we saw him, or I saw him, it looked like he was just out for a morning stroll. I mean, he's dominant. And some of the things that he's accomplished this year, you know, besides, you know, winning lots of races, he started something called the Summits of My Life, where he's breaking fastest known times on summiting some of these crazy high, like Mount McKinley. You know, he's doing Everest next year. Let's see, he has 1, 2, 3, 4 of the 7 on his list that he's already completed. I just think, has anyone ever been to Killian's
dominance? AJW, you're a historian of the sport.
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think he's got the incredible biology and physiology combined with just a passion and a love for what he does, and now of course the sponsorship support to do it. I can think of some single performances or some folks here in the United States, at least, who've dominated in certain areas. Matt Carpenter on Pike's Peak comes to mind. But the way Killian seems to do it, I'm not sure he has a peer. Now, in the mountaineering world, I understand that there are mountaineering records that are kept on some of these rather intense climbs, whether it's Aconcagua, which is the one he just broke, or the Matterhorn that he went after last year and broke. And I think that the mountaineers in the world might be able to comment more on that. But I think given it all, he's without peer in at least in ultra marathon running / mountain adventuring.
How many more years do you think he has?
He's 27 now, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's tough. You can go quite a ways with knowledge, experience, and an endurance sport. I mean, he could go conceivably.
And he's been going for a few years already.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't show signs of wearing out. He, you know, you and I have talked on this podcast before about the 7-year theory.
Yeah. Saw Chuck Seven.
Yeah, I think he's going to go past 7 years.
That's because I only had two good ones. It averages right out.
maybe you can give him 5 years.
Hey, you took him. Hey, you know, and so I was going to bring up the same topic, and I was going to cite Mount McKinley, that he went and shattered that record. You spoke of shattering 33 miles, 13,000 feet of elevation on that. Ed Warren, who had summited that from the start of the climb to the summit, he ran it in 12 hours and 29 minutes. Killian started and returned back in 11:40. Unbelievable. Hours and 6 minutes, he shattered that record. That is just, you know, there are times that we stand in front of, say, Babe Ruth in his record times, and maybe it's Tiger Woods in golf, but I think this is the time in at least mountaineering, ultra running, that we are witnessing 2014 year in review, right in the middle of strength of an amazing athlete.
Well, and I want to come back to the point, and then I want to get Ian's opinion on this, but I want to get back to the point of what Andy said. You know, he actually enjoys it. He has a very strong passion. When I saw him for the first time at Hard Rock, he was coming down a snowy slope and glissading down that slope on his shoes. And when he got to the bottom, he kind of quit running and was kind of looking around and talking to us. And you could see that he was just, he said, man, this is just beautiful out here. And he was there for the experience, not to win the race. I mean, he did win it, and that's one of his main purposes, but he was enjoying the experience probably more than many of us. So that's my comment. Ian, what do you think about Killian? Do you think he's going to continue to be dominant? What do you think about Killian?
Yeah, I don't see any signs of slowing down. And like you said, he has a passion for the sport. In 2010, the year they filmed Unbreakable at Western, I stood behind him in line, you know, to get our bib numbers and to photos and weigh in and medical check. And I couldn't believe how small and young he was. And I think he started at the right time, and he's got a good window, and he definitely has the support. And I think if all those things are there, you know, it just adds up to a machine or monster.
Do you guys think that there is the perfect size for ultra runner? Have you seen some consistencies? As I was doing my research, because that was, Scott, have I mentioned three times now?
That I stole it from you?
Yeah. that as I was doing my research, he's 5'7", 123 pounds, so that's his size. But we have runners like Tim Tweetmeyer that are certainly not 5'7", or 125. Do you guys have a sense of what the perfect size is for a ultra running athlete?
I don't. I don't think it matters. I think if you've got the heart and you've got the right training and I think there's some genetics involved, but I don't think it's physical size that is the genetic attribute that makes you or breaks you as an ultra runner.
Mm-hmm. Andy, I see you ready to.
Yeah, I've seen some.
Forward.
I mean, we've seen big guys. I mean, I'm a pretty big guy. Ian is not small. Hal's a big guy. Tim, you guys mentioned. We've seen big guys make it.
Look at Gordy. Gordy's a freaking Greek god.
Right. You've also seen little guys fall apart. You know, guys that are the same size as Killian. But I don't think there's any, I don't think you can point to a particular body type. I think especially when you go beyond 12, 15 hours, a lot more of it has to do with what's inside, you know, what's inside than what's outside.
Good point.
That's why I have hope.
Gong away, Scott. Because you lost the button.
Oh, where'd my gong go?
You know, you can't you can't lose your gong, Scott. We'll edit a gong in for
this
you.
This is a digital gong, and the digital has just gone. Gong. Well,
find it, and I'll go with my topic.
Your gong.
There we go.
Okay. So here's my topic. On some recent podcasts, we've been talking about decreasing mileage and not running such long distances, weekly mileage, in prep for 100. In fact, there's been some talk in the podcast, one by an author, Unbreakable, that we just had on, and then Seth, say the last name for me.
Kotelnicki.
And sorry, Seth. That he coached a runner that their maximum run, Monica Moores, was 13 miles in preparation for her 100-mile distance.
And a hard 100-mile. Yeah, pine to palm.
And so I feel that, well, especially with two great experienced runners that we have on the line right now, that I think we need a word of caution, especially for people that might be newer to the sport, to say, heck, all they needed was 13 miles. I'm plenty prepared for this. But, gosh, in my personal experience, I would be afraid to go out there with only 13 miles because I think there's a lot of things that we learn on the longer distances. One, we learn how to use our gut and how to feed ourselves and when we need electrolytes and how much water we can ingest before we have problems, how to work through bonks, how to see that things get better when things get bad, how to toughen up the feet so that they're ready for a 100-mile distance. And you can't do that with 13 miles. I just don't know how you do it. So as a word of caution, I feel at the end of 2014 review, we need to say, wait a second, maybe it's time to look at the general population and the bell curve. How do most people train for these things? And there's a lot of wisdom to what our ancestors here, or our four founders, have done with this sport. And 13 might not be enough. Scott, you're weighing in, and I'm ready to hear our masters here.
I think that you have a very good point. And in my opinion...
And I hope I took your second topic. Go ahead.
It was on my topic list, but in my opinion... The reason Monica Moore was successful with that training mode is because she was a very experienced ultra runner.
Yep.
She already had many 100-mile races underneath her belt. So to go out and say if you're new to the sport and it's your first 100-miler or first 50-miler to do that minimal training, I think that your success possibility is going to be low.
Okay, and I'm interested what these guys have to say because I just as my instincts tell me, and respect to both the guests that were on before. So, all right, gentlemen, weigh in if you'd like.
Well, I would say this. Let me start by saying the injury rates in running is higher than any other sport out there. If you took, I forget what the percentage is, but it's pretty high. I mean, how many of us have been injured?
All of us.
Yeah. If everyone listening to this podcast just did a collective yell, I think we'd all be deaf. So I am, and I think AJW knows this, I'm a pretty conservative coach. And I err on the side of being conservative. So if I was to coach a new runner and their goal was to run 100 miles and they had little to no background with running, and if we got to 13 miles and everyone was healthy and happy and we lined up healthy and happy on that 100 miler, I think success would be higher than if we went overboard and they never made the starting line at all.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I think, you know, for guys like Ian and I, look, we've been doing this for, you know, I think if you combine the two of us, we've probably been running ultras for almost 50 years. I have gone into hundreds undertrained, and I've gone into hundreds overtrained. And, you know, as the old saying goes, it's an experiment of one. But I really think you've got to put in the time on your feet. You've got to figure out what works for you. And you've got to then believe in your training. I coach runners and have I no longer put someone say looking for a 24-hour finish at Western States through a 100-plus mile weeks, but I will strongly recommend that they spend 5, 6, 7 hours on a single dose or back to back of a 5 and a 3 hour run to just get accustomed to what it takes to be out there that long, especially what it feels like once they get past, say, mile 70 or 80 in a 100-miler. There's no way that you can replicate that period in training, but you've got to be able to run tired. And I think that's a non-negotiable.
What do you think about using like races for training, AJW?
Oh, I mean if you're a runner and you're able to do that, it took me about 10 years to be able to do that. But once I was able to do it and I didn't feel bad about finishing 48th in a race, it was an aided training run.
Yeah.
So I do encourage runners to do that, especially if they can get past 10, 12 hours, say in 100K, to use those races as training runs, because it's really hard to get out there and do 10 hours just on a random weekend.
Yeah.
Now, how do you guys deal with, because I know that it happens when people run up next to you and go, "What are you doing back here? I must be going too fast." Or, I mean, those comments, I think, would wear me more than some of the hills.
I'll go first. At first it was a little annoying. I wondered, God, am I really getting slow? Or but as time passed and I realized, especially since say 2010 to last year, all I cared about was one race a year. I think people, if they came up on me and were around me, I think they understood. And maybe they were like, "Oh, this is great. Look, I'm running with, so-and-so." But, honestly, I think that's a challenge for some people. It turned out not to be a challenge for me, but there are times where it's a little bit annoying. They're like, "Oh, well, gosh, shouldn't you be up with those front guys?" And I kind of want to say, I've actually never been up with those front guys.
Except when you were.
Yeah.
Except then. Ian, do you have any comment on that, or you would like to take a pass and hit the gong?
No, it's not frustrating for me unless it is an A race and it's going like that. Yeah. That's where it really gets great to me. But, it's all about ultras are so long, and I usually have, no matter what race I'm running, if it's a training run or if it's my go-to race, if it's like JFK or whatever, the first half of the race, sometimes I'm going in and out. Well, more times than not, I'm always having a little pity party because I think I should be doing better than I am. But, if once I hang in there, there's a lot of that attrition starts happening. And then you start feeling better because you see the guy who just ran by you 20 miles later, he's by the side of the road or whatever. And I kind of fall back on that hope every time I run an ultra nowadays.
There's something empowering about moving through and feeling strong. We're a tight community and we would stop and help somebody, but it feels good when your race is going good. You feel like I made good decisions. You don't feel bad. I mean, you don't necessarily want to beat that guy as much as you just... It just empowers you to think, I made some good nutrition choices. I must have trained well. It makes you feel good.
Yeah.
And I hope that doesn't come off the wrong way. You're gonging us, Scott? We've got the gong. That means move on. AJW, I think you're up.
Yeah.
What are you drinking there? Sierra Nevada?
Of Sierra Nevada, of course. Yeah.
That's your go-to, isn't it?
It's 5:30 somewhere.
Would you like to find? Well, it's 4:15 here. So, in the next couple of days, we'll hear about the Ultra Runner of the Year, and it appears to be down to Rob Krar and Max King, and on the gal side, Ellie Greenwood and Rory Bozio, from what I can tell, and crunching the names and the numbers. But as a historian, I wanted to bring us back to 1999. Mm. And that was a year a good friend of Ian's and mine, Mark Godow, won the Ultra Runner of the Year. But Ian won 10 races that year.
More than that.
Yeah, in 1999.
Yeah.
So maybe turning the tables a little bit. That was 15 years ago. All right. And, you know, just last month, I was with Ian at the JFK 50, which has been a race he's now finished 20 times, 16 times, including just a month ago. He's finished it in under 7 hours, which is extraordinary for longevity in the sport. And so I wonder, while this may not be a year in the review topic, perhaps given the fact that as we get to this time of the year where we're celebrating the Ultra Runner of the Year, how a guy who won 10 races and was the runner-up for Ultra Runner of the Year back in 1999 is still going strong now, 15 years later.
I can tell you one of the reasons, one of my theories, it's because of his aerodynamic glasses. It's because he cuts through the wind faster than most of us.
That's one theory. My theory might be is the tights that he's known to wear. I would run fast too if I wore those. So it is amazing longevity. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, some of the attributes that Killian has. You know, having the right genetic components to do what he's doing, but you know, I would say that Ian has some genetic gifts there too. Not only to be an outstanding runner and very fast, but longevity in his body holding up to the number of miles that he has run is a gift too, a genetic gift.
So now, what's the real answer, Ian? Is he blushing? Can you see on the video? Yeah. Is he blushing?
Yeah, you guys. Well, thanks for all that, but. I think I just to be a part of the sport for so long and to see it change. And, you know, 15 years ago, I'd never thought I'd be talking to a computer to three other guys out across the country doing this. But I don't even think I had an email address back then. But thanks. I like what I do. And I think a lot of it has to do with not with really, you know, I'm knocking on wood, just being really wary of what my body's doing and how I feel and backing off when I need to, and having not so good races is part of the deal, and understanding that and also knowing that you can't always win 10 races in a year and being okay with that, and instead just enjoy the atmosphere and the people that you're with.
What have you changed, Ian, between these years, 1999 and 2014, 15 coming up, in your training? Do you approach it a bit different? What have you learned, or how have you modified based on you know, the years?
Yeah, I have all my logbooks, and I can look back and I can tell you exactly what I did in 1999 every day. But I was logging some high mileage, 120, 140 mile weeks was not out of the question. I was racing a lot of small, short races in between the ultras, a lot of 5Ks, 10Ks type stuff, and a lot of road stuff. And no specific quality work. I would team up with, you know, in that time I lived in Vegas, and there was Josh Brimhall being one of them, but guys there I could tie in with and go for a long run, and that would turn into my workout, because just trying to keep up with them. Nowadays I still join people for runs, but it's more casual. I don't know. You know, I talked with AJ about a little bit about JFK training, and I kind of get serious for that. I add some speed work in and some tempo work in starting in August to build up for that November race, just because, you know, it's an important race for me. So I like to do my best every time I toe the line there. And, yeah, I don't know.
I like what you brought up about doing some 5Ks and 10Ks, because I think we've come across that topic before of using that as some important speed training work that you can really only get by throwing yourself in the middle of one of those races. And as trail runners, we too often can get caught up in just the long weekend slog and the midweek runs and not really put ourselves into that fast turnover mode. So I think that's a wise piece of advice.
Hey, Don, can I follow up quickly here?
Absolutely.
Gong has not yet rung.
Yeah.
All right, good. So some of you guys may know that one of the names that was drawn in earlier this month's lottery was Ian. And so he's heading to Western States. You guys know how much I love that race. Mm-hmm. for what I assume will be his seventh finish. You've got six, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so Ian's got six finishes. By the way, dating back to 1998.
Wow.
Finish. I've done a little bit of homework here.
Yeah.
two of those six have been in the top 10.
Wow. Men. And, top 10 men.
Top 10 men. That's right. He did. And
Jason pushed me out of the top 10 overall.
She did that with a lot of people, Ian.
Yeah.
I had a year like that too, actually. So I know the feeling. But we've all heard about how the competition and the sport and this, that, and the other thing. But Ian, what's your thinking now? 6 months out. As you obviously you're back in the big dance for the first time since 2010, and you got a top 10 in 2006, which was that incredibly hot year that is somewhat famous for Western States aficionados. So as you go into the next 6 months, we know you've got a stable of athletes who you coach and a bunch of other people that are part of your life. What's going to be your thinking and your planning as you go into getting ready for Western States 2015, which, by the way, I'll be along to watch the whole time, but would love to just hear a little bit about that 6 months out.
Yep. I sat down last week with a spreadsheet and plugged in some events that I know I'm going to be doing before Western, put Western at the end of the spreadsheet. That's a lot of blanks to fill in. And I looked at it, and then I went and drank a beer. And I came back and looked at it again, drank another beer, and then I turned off my computer and went to bed. The next day, I opened up it again, was staring at this spreadsheet, and I just gave it to Emily. So she's building my Western States training. I haven't seen it yet, and she's still working on it. It's supposed to start on the 5th, so we'll see what happens. But I'm going with a structured program. Emily and I will sit down with what she comes up with, and we'll probably tweak it a little bit. But we'll see what happens.
I think that is fascinating.
The coach recruits a coach.
Yeah, the coach recruits a coach.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Now, have you coached her, Ian?
Yes.
Now,
I've coached her since the first time I coached her was that epic battle with her and Ellie at JFK. Was that 3 years ago?
Are you fearful of some paybacks here?
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But I just couldn't do it. I couldn't build my program. I'd build tons of programs. I'd build programs on a daily basis, and I could not build mine, and I couldn't look at it. So I gave it to Emily, and so she's working on it.
Well, from where I sit 6 months out, from one desert guy to another, among other things, I really hope it's a hot day for you, buddy.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
The hotter, the better.
AJW, we all know that you have, this is a first year in a long time that then you have your 10 in and you're not running this year. I'm going to ask you this question. Have you looked at the snow level yet up there?
Of course I have.
That's his home screen, Don.
I know.
When he logs in, that's what he sees.
I have a little thing that beeps on my and I've heard there's been some big dumps in the last couple of weeks.
There has, yeah.
There's a lot of snow up there.
Oh, that's it. Western States is in your blood. There's no doubt. You may not have a bib, but you'll be out on the course and working and paying back.
He'll probably be running more miles watching the race than he will be running it.
I heard him looking for Ian as, do you need a crew, buddy? Do you need somebody to pace you through the last miles? I heard that in his setup.
No, I have to admit, I'm completely committed to Thornley. He's told me to not make any plans.
What are you doing? What are you going to be doing?
He hasn't told me yet. I think it's going to be bad. He does want me to interview the winners when they finish. So
here's what I heard. I heard he sat down with a big spreadsheet and it was blank. He drank a beer, then he went away, and he came back, and then he shut it down.
And he's going to say, Andy, can you please run Western States 100?
He was trying to think of Andy's job. He just couldn't come up with it yet.
Yeah.
Okay, so where are we at? The gong has gonged.
There we go.
We're moving to the next topic. I believe Ian's up. Yes?
Ian is up.
I have two more topics. One might be cooler than the other, so I'll just go with that one right now. Two things. The birth of the 200-mile race.
Oh, Ian, that was mine. Oh. That was my second one. Dang it.
You better come up with something quick, Scott.
Sorry. And also, tying in with that, the change in the Western States qualifying races and how that is changing the map of the races that we're seeing now across the country.
Wow, that's coming strong with this entry number two. So you have some general comments that you'd like to throw in there, some thoughts that you have on it, Ian, or are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was amazed by they had a successful Tahoe 200, right? And,
yes.
And they had to have a lottery for that because they were limited to the numbers, and they're doing it again. I just saw an email. They're firing that up, but I believe there's one more. They're adding one.
Yeah.
And then there's also the talk of one happening here in Arizona as well, on the Arizona Trail. If that comes to fruition or not, we'll see. But it seems to be a new trend. Is now the 200-miler going to overshadow the 100-miler? And then also we're seeing a lot of events adding that 100K distance to their race for the hopes of becoming a Western States qualifier.
Huh. I actually like the there's more 100Ks popping up. I mean, you know, 5 years ago there were 3-4 in the United States probably.
I don't know.
Andy probably knows.
And no, Andy
it's
knows
tattooed
exactly
how many. Tattooed on his forearm.
Well, Andy, what's your thoughts on the 200-mile distance? Is it going to overtake the 100-mile? Is 100-mile just a half a race now, or you know, what's your view on this?
Well, I don't think it's going to overtake the 100, but I think it adds a level of intrigue to the sport, and it certainly creates opportunities for older guys like Ian and I. You know, I think it goes without saying that the longer we go, the better off experience and knowing how to take care of yourself when things get ugly comes into play. And for prior to this burgeoning 200 movement, the only way we could do that is to go to 72-hour races or things like that. So I think that's a cool little thing sort of personally. It also adds that the dynamic that's added with, you know, having to spend the night and, you know, going in and possibly having, you know, hours or several hours at aid and taking care of yourself into that larger amount of time is intriguing. I was as far as the qualifying for Western States, I mean, I'm a broken record in that I thought, you know, a decade ago they needed to make a 100-miler a prerequisite. The board and other people involved said, no, you know, we can't do that. Gordy didn't have to run a 100-miler before he ran Western States. We still want to make Western States the opportunity for someone to have it be their first 100. So it really created this cottage industry of 100Ks. I think 100K is a cool distance because you get to that place where your stomach starts to go south. You can't go, unless you're super fast, you can't go completely on gels and fluids for 100K. But it has created a growth market. I mean, my race out here, the Thomas Jefferson 100K, I've gone back and forth with Thornley, you know, about it. How can I really want to be a Western States qualifier? He says, well, you got to get enough entrance. I said, well, as soon as I become a Western States qualifier, I'm going to get enough entrance.
Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, and then the cycle goes. And so it's interesting. But it, more than that, it does give credence to the power or at least influence of that event. I mean, that event declared that no longer 50-milers would be qualifiers. And the next thing you know, every 50-miler in the world is trying to figure out a way to tack on 12 miles.
You know, do you see that there's going to be an increase in popularity? And maybe you've seen it in 2014 with these timed races. You know, that you mentioned, Andy, the 72-hour. Do you see more ultras being a 24-hour, 48-hour, 72-hour, or beyond?
Not really. I don't, because we're in the bucket list era, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at, let's take Hard Rock for example. Hard Rock's lottery earlier this month had over 1,200 people who were entering the lottery for the first time. They only had 179 people who were in the lottery having run the race between 1 and 4 times. Wow. So there are quite a few people out there who want to do these things once and then move on to whatever else they're going to do in their lives. And I think that's the case with Western States. So until the 24-hour, 48-hour, 72-hour event has that kind of allure, at least in terms of the modern bucket list person, I don't see that happening.
Do you guys have a 200 miler on your bucket list?
Ooh, good question, Don.
I saw your paper. How about you, Ian? Are you intrigued?
It is very tempting, yeah. And I bookmarked it, and I'm on. Like I said, I'm on their e-newsletter list, but not this year.
Well, unless Emily puts it on your spreadsheet, right?
Right.
And you might have Craig might put that on your spreadsheet, Andy.
you have to run from Auburn to Squaw Valley and back.
And back, yeah. No, I definitely have the Tahoe too. Not for 2015, but similar to Ian, I have that Tahoe race on my list, and am also on the getting the emails. So you guys outed us.
Yeah. You know, one second before you ring that gong, Scott, I see you winding up over there. Hey, the Hoka. Andy, I saw you running out at Lake Sonoma.
And are you changing the subject?
No. I just.
Oh, okay.
Kind of on a parallel, kind of a tangent. And you were coming back from an injury, and you were wearing a Hoka as an experiment to see if you could get some miles in. Do you really see that shoe as helpful to recover, or as we age as runners that become a little more kind? Do you have a position on that? And Ian, you're going to come up next if you don't mind, if you have a thought. Otherwise, you can pass.
Well, actually, I've gotten to like these newer Hokas, the two I mentioned, the Clifton earlier and the Hawaka, which are a little less beefy than the huge ones that have been sort of the hallmark of the brand.
Right.
I probably like Ian. I mean, my closet out in the front has probably 24 pairs of shoes in it at any given time, and I never really know what I'm going to put on when I start a run. But
how do you choose? By color?
No, I choose
cleanliness
by my mood. So yeah, I mean, I like we led with the year of maybe coming back to equilibrium when it comes to shoes. I still think we have a ways to go, but maximalism is what's selling. Mm-hmm. You know, my friends out at San Francisco Running Company have said, Hoka's helped them keep the lights on in their first year. Now, of course, they're a lot bigger and they're more well established. But let's face it, you know, if you can extend your running career with a nice cushy pair of shoes, regardless of how goofy they look or how Euro the colors are, you're probably going to do it.
Ian, should we gong or do you got a comment?
I do real quick before you hit it. I think this variety is really important because I've worked with a number of athletes. Again, I always fall back on the people I've worked with in the past, and you know, the minimal stuff works for some people, but the maximal stuff works for other people. And I think it's whatever makes you comfortable and able to get out and have a good run. And so, I don't know, we'll see what happens, but that's just my opinion that I think we'll continue to see diversity.
I haven't seen the Vibrant Five Fingers out there too much anymore. That was, I have
after,
mine, but
after their lawsuit, man,
I have mine, but they're a bit buried underneath a few other other models. Okay, Scott, coming strong with the gong. Who's up? I think it's you, Scott.
Okay, this is one. It's a weak one, but I think we can bring it up, and then we'll quickly gong and go on.
We'll support
in fact,
it and strengthen it.
In fact, you can look at me, and if there is no comment, I can bring it up, and we can gong right away.
You could gong yourself at the end if you don't like the way it feels.
And this goes back to we've had multiple podcasts on this subject. I want to know, in 2014, is the trail running culture healthy? Or are we getting to the point where there's a dramatic change with the increased number of people participating?
I'm going to lead with that, and I was on a run this morning, and it was at the top of a hill, and it was a dark 30, and I was out there and
Petzl 30,
and coming up, I had my ears in listening to something, and I took my left one out because as the runner was coming down on this wide path, I was going to be able to greet him and say hello. But this runner with full lights on, and he was a full-on ultra runner by the looks of his gear, didn't even acknowledge or say
didn't
hello
say
or anything. Ooh. And I thought, well, I must be, you know, it just didn't feel right. I thought, doggone it, culture means and dictates that we greet one another and say hello. And
did you look menacing to him?
I'll tell you what I did. I turned around with all of my 350 lumen from my Petzl Now, and I beamed at him and waited for him to turn around so I could greet him and say hello.
That's not a laser, Don. You can't.
So that's my comment. I think culture is passed on, and I think that maybe he was just concentrating on something else. And I've probably done that to someone, and that's how I walked away from it. But I think culture is something that's important to all of us, and probably to that runner too. So I'm passing it over to Ian or Andy. Chime in if you'd like.
This is Andy here. I
we know Andy.
we recognize your voice.
Good. It's a caller from Montvale, New Jersey. First time caller, long time listener. I'm actually, the reason I'm hesitating is I'm writing something for this Friday's Tap Room about expectations management. I think that is what that's the source of a lot of these cultural angst we're feeling in the sport. The runners who plop down what they find to be an exorbitant entry fee take certain expectations for the event. Race directors have certain expectations of the services that they should have from Forest Service or whatever else. Sponsored athletes have higher expectations about what they should receive from their sponsors. It seems to be an accelerating stage of expectations. And gone are the days, I'm afraid, where Ian and I could roll into San Juan Bluebird Campground in Cleveland National Forest in 1997 and run one of Baz Hawley's, you know, 50K races with two aid stations and minimal course markings on a beautiful trail. And what I'd like to challenge the trail running community of the United States to do in 2015 is to not lose sight of the values that we were built on. You know, some of these historic races, just, you know, being at JFK, Ian's most noteworthy race last month, you know, while that's 52 years old and has over 1,000 runners and is a really, really challenging logistical event for Mike Spindler to organize, it really feels like a small race. which is extraordinary. Every runner is taken care of. The course is what it is. There's no expectation one way or another that it's going to be something other than it is. And those are the values that I think, if we're not careful, if we don't emphasize, hey, look, you know what? We're standing on the shoulders of people who didn't have a whole lot of expectations when they showed up for a run in the woods, and now you guys do. And I think it is incumbent on people who've been around a while, like Ian and I and Hal and others in the sport, to make sure we continue to keep that alive.
Yes. Well stated. Ian?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's great.
Self-gonged. I don't know if you're allowed to gong your own topic.
Gong my topic. And we got some good rebuttalness.
Yeah. Hey, so I'll,
you're up.
I'm up. Popularity. You know, the sport's growing. And so this is my third. This is my on deck. This is my reserve topic that I had to come up with after you for my fifth comment on this, that you took my Killian Jornet. Popularity. The sport's growing, and it's growing. We can see that with race attendance. We can see it on a Saturday when we go out and run the trail. Are we going to flatten out? Is 2014 have we reached the summit, or are we still climbing? And so that's my down and dirty short question. What do you think? Whoever speaks up first is the one that answers.
It's growing, and it's going to continue to grow. It's slowly reaching people, and I think it takes books like the books, and it takes the movies like the movies.
Yeah,
we've all talked about on this podcast before that get the word out, and people. I think it's cool. I mean, people think it's cool. People know it's cool, and people have fun doing it. And it's just a matter of exposure, and it's getting that now. It's not a black and white magazine that you have to order that comes out of some guy's garage that has five pages in it. It's now, it's huge. It's online. It's everywhere. So it's getting bigger. And you know, I'm working with people who, you know, 2 years ago had no idea it existed. So
good.
I agree with Ian completely. And I think the 2 years ago, people didn't even know what existed thing is an interesting one, because for every person who comes into the sport, and just jumps right in, there's the others who jump in and then leave without thinking twice about it. And so what I see is that what people like you guys, Don and Scott, with the Trail Runner Nation can do, and in my opinion should do, is continue to try to shape the culture in ways that are appropriate to what's best for trails. And I think those are, you know, sustainability and taking care of the environment. They're a healthy lifestyle. They're the celebrating community over the individual. They're all of the psychological and emotional benefits that come from long distance running, in addition to the physical benefits. You know, that's, if we can continue to emphasize those aspects of the sport, then we can really leverage the growth in positive ways. I really agree with Ian. It's not going away, you know, but when you read about the issues around overused trails and litter and challenges that various parks service and county parks people are facing with overrun trails and not enough bathrooms and all those things, I think we're playing a lot of catch up in that regard. And I hope that people are listening.
You know, I think it's incumbent on all of us to share that culture with the people we find out on the trail. Like this morning, you should have just punched the guy.
No,
I'm joking. I'm joking.
I actually feel bad that I even brought that up. I feel like, you know, I'm the jerk of the podcast here.
No,
my now light at him.
But you know, there's more information, and I was going to say, one of the things in 2014, at least in my view, is 2014 was the year of the ultra movie. There's so many movies. I mean, prior to this year, there was Unbreakable. I mean, and there was maybe one or two other really iconic ultra
films.
Race
for the Soul.
Yeah, Race for the Soul. But this year, there were a bunch of them that came out, you know? JB Benn is still out there making movies about ultras. You know, we have our friend Billy Yang who did a couple this year. I think that there's a lot of movies out there.
There's some talented people, and tools are becoming more accessible. Some Final Cut Pro on Apple. You can produce movies
with
your iPhone
and an app.
So are there any other predictions out there? Would you like to do a prediction before we, because we're into this pretty deep? Are there any predictions for 2015 that you guys have?
This year, here in Flagstaff, we have a Flagstaff running series. It's a series of five or six races. They're half marathon and below in distance, but they're on the trails. And this year, Purina has a big company or a big factory here in town. They paid the entries for many of their employees so they could run the series kind of as a perk, health benefit, yeah. Promote
wellness. Health.
Yeah, wellness. Do we see Google purchasing entries for their employees to run ultras in 2015?
That would be awesome. Really? It would be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we need to lobby our politicians to have ultras count as a preventative health procedure.
Yes, please.
Google could buy Marin Headlands and open that race up.
Or California.
Or that. Andy, any predictions?
I'm with Ian on that. I think the Trails for Every Man movement will continue. And whether it's Purina, Google, or just opening up the world of trail running to the masses will continue. I think also, in terms of a specific prediction, I think we will see, back on people for a second, I think we'll see a surprise winner of a major 100-mile race, someone who comes out of nowhere and wins a big 100-mile race. I have no idea who it is or which race, but I think it's going to happen.
Wow.
Look at Alex Varner. He is just come onto the scene and just done very, very well. A very strong runner. It's been fun to watch him.
Indeed. Indeed. A PS is that this is also, and I know Ian is one, I'm not really one, but it's also been a little bit of the year of the ultra coach where, I think there's now enough known about the sport and what it takes to succeed in the sport that there's a coach for every type of person. But I think that that people who want to learn how to do it now have ways to learn other than just slogging around for 8 hours with guys like me in the mountains. And I think I'd like to see that trend continue too, because that's how you have finishing rates increase and so on and so forth.
And I would say along that topic, AJW, that you are probably the best value coach out there because you just work for beer. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. But you get what you pay for.
Well, I think those are some good. Scott, do you have any predictions that you want to make that's on your mind?
My prediction is the sun will rise.
Well, you certainly, sir, will be correct on that prediction. Well, Andy, you mentioned earlier that things that Trail Runner Nation can do to help, send the message of culture and remind us what's important. But really, we can't do it without guys like Ian and yourself.
Yes.
that are out there that have the time. We're kind of we may have created the stage, but we're not the actors. And we do appreciate you guys sharing and keeping us on track and teaching and extending what trail running is all about. So you guys are awesome, and we sure appreciate
we do.
You coming on.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for the invites, always.
Yeah, indeed, Don and Scott, thank you so much. And Ian, I look forward to following your training starting on the 5th.
Hey, yeah. I want to see if you're willing to. I would love to see that training schedule once Emily puts it together.
Yeah, I'll. If you guys remind me, I can share that. You can also, and this was one of my things, was the rise of social media. But in 2014, something like Strava. But I'm on Strava, and if you want to follow me on Strava, I'll be doing it there. And
wow,
I'm not an active Facebooker. I only Facebook kind of big events. So, but you can see me there every day.
So we mentioned you guys are race directors. Put a shout out for each one of your races so that we can point ourselves, if we're making our own race calendars, where we can go experience one of your races and see what a race looks like from a runner's perspective. And why don't you start, Ian?
I'm going to plug two. I'm going to plug Flagstaff to Grand Canyon Stagecoach Line 100 miler, which also this year, 2015, we've added a 55K. And they're both point-to-point Arizona Trail, northern Arizona, go over the shoulder of Humphreys and work your way to the Grand Canyon. And then the other, that's in September, September 26th. And then the other is Bootlegger 50K, which is right outside of Sin City, Las Vegas. And that's early November, November 8th, I believe, this year, or 9th. So.
Good, good. And if we wanted to follow you, do some coaching, where would we find you to connect with some coaching?
You can find me at mcmillanrunning.com.
Awesome. Andy, tell us a little bit about your venues, your races, and what's coming up.
Yep, we've got the Thomas Jefferson 100K, which is on March 14th at Walnut Creek Park here in Charlottesville. It is a got about 8,000 feet of vertical, a beautiful all single track course, we're in our second year. And then along with Crozet Running, we stage, starting at high noon on the first Saturday in August, the Jarman's Invitational Marathon, otherwise known as the Gym. It goes up and down a 3,000-foot climb five times. I'm the aid station captain at the top of the climb, where we have Bud Light, a warm sponge bath, and country music playing.
Oh, I don't know which was the worst of the three there. Yeah.
I would also like to suggest, if you're interested in coaching, you can just contact me via irunfar@ajwstaproom.com, and you can read whatever I have to say, good, bad, or indifferent, every Friday morning on irunfar as well.
And leave some comments. You know, the comments are almost as entertaining as your actual entries, Andy. I just have to say that. You've got some talented and interesting readers out there.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
So, Scott, you want to wind this thing up?
I just wanted to say, because we haven't said it yet.
Uh-oh.
Thank you to the headmaster. as always, as a accomplished headmaster, he came prepared.
Thanks, guys.
Did his research.
Thanks, guys. Now, Trail Runner Nation, go to trailrunnernation.com. We're working on revamping that website, even though it's a strong website. Something new's coming.
It's going to be a surprise.
Okay. And then the Web Ninja's working on that.
It is.
Do you have any wearables left? We have some hats left, right?
We do have lots of hats. We do have some leftovers from our hoodies and T-shirts. We'll be posting those on the website in the coming weeks.
So happy New Year to everyone, and get out there and run.
Mass.